Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this evening's the full moon of January. It's a lunar observance night, and also it's beginning the transition going into our winter retreat time. And tomorrow will be a rest day, but say the day after, we'll begin with a full schedule, start with morning chanting and group sitting, instruction, evening pujas. We'll begin pretty standard, get the ball rolling with group practice. And just to give a few reflections around the opportunity to be having retreat time. Of course, there's a couple different meanings to retreat, and one is pulling back from busyness or various duties, creating more solitude for oneself, which is really what we're doing. Of course, retreat also has the meaning of actually going backwards or retreating, and that's decidedly what we're not doing. The opportunity for increased solitude, a bit more time for formal practice has the hopefully the effect of encouraging us forward being a support for our ongoing growth and development in the practice. You know, from the time of the Buddha recommended periods of retreat. The traditional rainy season period is a time for, say, developing what are called samana dhammas. And the samana dhammas are the, say, you know, the teachings and practices that lead to a quality of peace and renunciation or relinquishment. So that this opportunity for retreat is hopefully a opportunity for shedding a lot of the various burdens that we carry, whether it's a external burdens of possessions, duties, responsibilities, but more importantly, internal burdens of our moods and propensity for complicating our life, complicating our own minds, shedding the various worries and fears that are part and parcel of our human condition. But we can be shedding and relinquishing so much of those habits. And retreat time is an opportunity to understand them more clearly, and you know, so much is accomplished through being willing to understand both our own habits and tendencies, but also the just the habits and tendencies of the human condition and others. It's so ingrained in us to react and get caught up in cycles of reaction. And you realize that there's a lot more simpler ways of looking at it and relinquishment and shedding are a treat that we can give ourselves, rather than the sort of the complications and burdens that we tend to carry. I think of course, of Ajahn Chah, who exemplified in so many ways just a clarity of perception that cut through so much of the crap that we sort of douse ourselves in on a fairly regular basis. And just think of some of the kind of humorous ways that he would look at things, and just that, because so often, it's so easy to get swept up in kind of the sense of kind of views and opinions, how we should be, how others should be, how the world should be, and if only it were this way, and if only that way, and if only he didn't do it like that, then it wouldn't be such a problem. And Ajahn Chah is coming up with that perception that's like so much of it is just like, and of course many of the images that he has, he's from rural northeastern Thai background, and it's just village life, and it's just ordinary to have ducks and chickens around, and at that sense of you're trying to make a duck into a chicken, and it's just they're different, and that's what it's like. And ducks are like that, chickens are like that, and you get wound up trying to make a duck into a chicken, and it's just sort of, and it's just as silly as that. So much of our, the things that we either get upset about or worried about or fearful about, I look at it from a different perspective, and it's just, why am I trying to make this duck into a chicken? And you realize, it's not such an extraordinary problem. It's not such a difficult position, really. The sense that so much of the the image that Ajahn Chah gives of the walking past this big rock plinth that's in the front of the ordination hall at his monastery, and just sort of asking, is that rock heavy? And of course it's a huge rock, and it's ordinary to just sort of say, it's heavy, it's huge, it's big. And he said, it's not heavy if you don't pick it up. And just that kind of simple reflection, recollection, reminder. And because we end up picking up so much that we really don't have to. And of course, when we pick it up, it's heavy. If we let things be more, then or at least if you're going to pick something up, then be really conscious of the fact that, I'm going to pick this up and I'm going to hold it. And you have this sense of really making it clear, what am I doing? Because so much of it is habitual, or just the assumption or compulsion that, I've got to carry it, I've got to pick it up. And to be able to be really clear. And that's one of the, when I was thinking of this winter retreat, to be reviewing, in terms of a kind of a theme, for, at least for a while anyway, just picking up the foundations of mindfulness and exploring them and reflecting on them and how to implement them. Because that sense of mindfulness, one, we have oftentimes have many assumptions of what it is, but also just how just trying to reestablish in our practice how central those foundations of mindfulness are to the Buddha's teachings. The discourse that the Buddha gives on the foundations of mindfulness, he says that, you know, this is, as I say, the direct path for the overcoming of suffering and the purification of beings. And there is a variety of interpretations around the word in Pali, ekayana maggo. And some people sort of say, this is the only path, but I think is a bit dogmatic, and a better way of maybe interpreting that, the phraseology, it's a path that goes in one direction only, and that's for the purification of beings and the overcoming of suffering. That's what it's for. That's what its function is. And to be able to learn how to implement, to use, to cultivate these foundations of mindfulness. And just the word mindfulness, its root of the word is in memory, so that it's also the sense of recollecting, bringing to mind, applying the full mind to what we're doing, and of course it has a variety of qualities to it that it's not just a focusing of the mind, or just having a one-pointed attention. And there's discernment functioning there. There's it's like Ajahn Chah would say, there needs to be some wisdom and some discernment functioning there. There needs to be some appropriate context for our use of mindfulness, he said, because a thief has mindfulness, and otherwise they wouldn't be able to steal successfully, wouldn't be able to get away with it. But that's not really an appropriate use of directing attention. Think of somebody who is applying mindfulness applying the mind towards an unwholesome goal, a sniper in a military setting, has to be able to apply the mind, has to be attentive. But is that mindfulness from a Buddhist perspective? So starting to tease out some of these one assumptions that we have, but then teasing out the kind of purpose and goal that the Buddha has. And I think it comes back to that very first sentence in the Buddha's discourse, saying there is this direct path for the overcoming of suffering and the purification of beings. And that's really the purpose and function of mindfulness. And it's important to be able to keep that in mind as we practice, as we cultivate, as we develop, and as we go through this 3-month period of retreat in an ideal world. That's what we hopefully recollect and remind ourselves of. And I know what my mind used to do when I started retreat, and so that certainly wasn't for overcoming suffering. It was sort of, somehow I kept managing to make more suffering for myself. but those are the things that we have to learn from. And over a period of as we continue to practice, build a momentum of retreat practice, there's an inevitable clarity that develops. It's just it's the nature of, say, a retreat time. And of course our minds will go up and down through that time. There'll be periods of where we're energetic, periods where you wonder where the heck our energy went. There'll be periods where there's kind of inspiration and confidence. There'll be periods where there's doubt and difficulty. But, those are kind of natural cycles that we have to be willing to reflect on, investigate, and learn from. And that's what, in the Buddhist teachings, what the Buddha lays out when we call it, say, like a path of practice, is also another idiom that he uses is in the scriptural language, is sikha, which is oftentimes literally translated as training, but it has a constellation of meanings, but it's also learning and studying. So learning, studying, practicing, training. It has all that kind of constellation of meanings or spectrum of meanings. So that, as we as we practice and cultivate the different aspects of the practice, whether it's cultivation of mindfulness, cultivation of our restraint, cultivation of our settling of the mind, cultivation of our investigation and contemplation. We have to be open to, how do we learn from this? How do we study this? How do we reflect on it? How do we skillfully train so that we begin to create a natural understanding? Because it's really learning through doing rather than, because the Buddhist teachings aren't about, more information or more data. It's around it's like Ajahn Chah used to say, you point picks up his little finger and sort of say, yeah, if you study that much, stick your little finger and then practice this much, and that's, you know, it's the length of your arm. Yeah, that's got things in proportion. So that the understanding that we gain from the teaching is really from, you know, putting into practice, experimenting. What works, what doesn't work, what's helpful, what's not helpful. What's helpful today, but actually isn't helpful tomorrow. You know, what works? Because those are all things that we learn from. And this is part of the sikha, of sort of the training. And this is what, say, when we take our bhikkhu ordination, our monk's ordination, that's sort of the exhortation that I give at the end of the ordination, is sort of encouraging to pay attention to the higher sort of adi sila sikasi kitaba, adi citta sikasi kitaba, adi banya sikasi kitaba. That, you know, developing and cultivating that, say, the higher or the training in higher virtue, the training in the heightened mind, and the training in heightened discernment and wisdom, so that there's an ability to penetrate and see through things, so that the this opportunity that we have for retreat is a opportunity to experiment with things that say have been working for us in the past, and then to apply them, to develop them, and develop more refinement with it, to pick up different practices or ways of holding the teaching. And investigating now, sort of, there's really a plethora of teachings and practices, and it's just this, and it's through investing time and energy, and then that one starts to understand, okay, is this useful? Is this beneficial? Does it work for me? But also, how do we gauge that, of course? And the deciding factor is always in terms of result. What's the result? Is there an increase in peaceful mental states and a decrease in sort of agitated mental states? Is there an increase in stability and a decrease in restlessness? Is there an increase in bright states of mind and a decrease in dull states of mind? Is there an increase in kind of spaciousness of mind and a decrease of the kind of contracted feelings of mind? So those are some of the indications. And okay, yeah, if that's what's happening, then yeah, the practice is going on it's heading in the right direction. Of course, if the opposite is true, then it's sort of indication, okay, I need to readjust, reconfigure. I need to learn from this to understand it more clearly. so that as we practice, as we take this retreat period, then there's going to be teachings given, there's going to be readings given, but also, in the end, it's really up to us what we take responsibility for bringing the teachings into the heart. That's, when we do the chanting, one of the characteristics of the Dhamma is Opanayika Dhamma. It's a Dhamma, it's a teaching that leads inwards. It's leading into the heart, drawing it back into that the heart base and learning how to recognize from there, okay, what's there? As we use the the four foundations of mindfulness as a base for, say, practice and reflection and cultivation, I think one of the things that I saw very early on in my practice was that when we pick that up and use that skillfully, the natural result is one of relinquishment and a sense of coolness in the heart, but also a kind of a real understanding of the Buddha's teaching or his encouragement to recognize the non-self nature of things that sense that we're that habit this is mine, this is what I am, this is me, that doesn't really have a basis. It has a basis, but the basis is one of kind of illusory or delusional that leads us to suffering. And so that seeing that window of opportunity for relinquishing that habit of, as in the idiom that the Buddha uses, the I-making, the mind-making, the underlying tendency to conceit. And conceit from the Buddha's perspective is not just holding oneself up and looking down on others, but it's sort of whatever position of self, whether it's one feeling inferior, feeling equal, feeling superior, whatever position one holds, that's a type of conceit that separates oneself from the opportunity to experience truth and reality. So that seeing where these teachings can take us, seeing where one is how to implement them, but also recognizing, okay, what are the possibilities? And of course, the possibilities are freedom from suffering and liberation. And is it bit by bit, getting a confidence, getting a sense of encouraging oneself and increasing faith in the tools that we have to be at hand and what we can be relying on. So those are some thoughts for reflection this evening. I don't have much steam, so I'm not going to go on very long. That's enough.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu.